With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to the 55th episode of Warriors Off Court, the San Francisco Chronicles NBA podcast. I'm your host, Warriors beat writer Connor Letourneau, and today I'm joined by Chronicle sports columnist Scott Osler. Scott and I are in LA for the Warriors' first round series against the Clippers. On Friday afternoon, we caught up about Kevin Durant's big game three, the center rotation post to Marcus Cousins, why this series is the Clippers' audition for free agents, and much, much more. We'll have our conversation right after the break. Scott Osler and I chatted in Scott's hotel room on Friday afternoon, a little more than 12 hours after the Warriors read a 38-point gem from Kevin Durant to a convincing win over the Clippers in Game 3. To kick things off, I asked Scott about his biggest takeaway from a series in which Golden State leads 2-1.
Biggest takeaway has been the whole Durant scene, the whole drama surrounding Durant, because I don't think it's over because of one game. He had one fantastic game. It was a breakthrough game after his previous couple games where he wasn't shooting. And in recent weeks, basically, where he's kind of been on a, okay, I'll show you, I'll just pass the ball, I'm not going to shoot anymore, and nobody can figure out what's going on. I've talked to a couple of people around the league. They say, what is the deal with Durant? Well, what's going on? And so he busted out of it last night, but that whole thing is going to be an ongoing drama, I think.
Yeah, so to kind of fill in the listener, I'm sure you guys have all been paying attention, but after Game 2 was a weird game because – Durant only attempted 8 shots. Keep in mind, this is a guy who, over the course of his career, has averaged around 19 shots per game. He only attempted 8 shots. He had more turnovers than shots. He had 9 turnovers, a lot of which were off offensive fouls against Beverly, who was, you know, almost a foot shorter than him, but obviously bothering him a lot. Durant had a really detailed explanation for his reasoning for not attempting so many shots and was downright obstinate when told that Kerr had publicly encouraged him to take 20 to 30 shots in the next game. Durant said, you know, I'm Kevin Durant. Y'all know who I am. Basically saying, you know, don't question me. I'm a Hall of Fame player. I'm one of the greatest scorers of all time. I know what I'm doing. And that's not my game. My game isn't necessarily to decide beforehand to go out and shoot 30 shots. And then what happens?
But then you made it worse because the next day you asked Kerr, did you guys basically sit down and talk, or do you think it's your place to sit down and talk to him? And Kerr momentarily exploded on you, and he kind of got mad, but then he kind of played it off like he was kidding. So it was a weird scene.
I talked to some people in the organization about that today, and they basically said, you know, don't take it personally. Yeah. It's a sensitive topic. And I totally understand that. I don't think Steve's mad at me. I don't think there's anything like that. I just think there's so much scrutiny on this team. And right now there's a lot of scrutiny focused on his dynamic with Durant. You know, there's been a lot of, I don't want to say a lot, but there's been probably a handful of times this season where Durant has either subtly or obviously thrown Steve under the bus or publicly disagreed with him and been just straight up obstinate and about his head coach. Yeah. And got to wonder if that is an issue kind of simmering under the surface this season.
Yeah, let's psychoanalyze this just a tiny bit. So after last night's game, huge night for Durant right from the start, came out smoking, was phenomenal, was everything Kevin Durant could be. And afterwards, when he was asked, you know, what was the difference? What happened? He said, well, coach called some plays for me right from the start. So what's your take on that? Is that him saying, all right, I appreciate that Coach Kerr called some plays for me to kind of get me going early, to kind of get me in the shooting groove and everything? Or was that him saying, yeah, okay, now it's all about the coach? And I don't know how to read that. I really don't. What's your take on that?
Well, keep in mind, he says that pretty soon after Kerr tells everyone, I didn't do anything. It was just a change in mindset. He was just more aggressive. And for whatever reason, Durant doesn't seem to like the narrative of, you know, him feeling like he needed to do anything. You know, he needed to get more shots up. He wants everyone to know that he is doing what the game dictates and what his coach dictates, not what he personally feels. And I think that's very important to him. Kerr came back today and said, well, you know, I did tweak some things. That's probably what he was referring to. I did, you know, make a couple of adjustments to find him his spots. And Curry kind of reiterated that last night, that there were some minor adjustments. But I lean toward believing Kerr's initial statement, which was that Durant was just more aggressive, because he came out opening possession, hit, knocked down an elbow 18-foot jumper, and from there on was really commanding the offense. He made his 6 first shots, had 27 points at halftime, and was Durant at his best, really leading them to that big cushion, and then was able to sit for the entire fourth quarter.
Yeah, and tell me what you think about this, Connor, but to me, that game last night against admittedly an overmatched opponent, not a great opponent, although a playoff team, to me, that was the kind of game that the Warriors were hoping that they would get from Durant all the time when they got him. In other words, he got almost all of his points in the flow of the offense. It was moving, there was a cutting, there was flow to it. It wasn't one of those deals where, okay, 2 passes, and then dump it into Durant, and he takes 12 dribbles and fires up a follow-away, and everything comes to a standstill where everybody watches him. I thought it was done in the flow, and it was really, you know, it was beautiful basketball. It wasn't just one-on-one stuff.
Yeah, a lot of times it feels like when Durant has a big game, the Warriors kind of need to sacrifice what they do well and kind of just feed him for isolation situations. That was definitely not the case last night. He was getting his shot in the flow of the offense. They were moving the ball. When Durant wasn't knocking down shots, other guys were getting open looks. He found Clay for several easy shots, including that big dunk. He found Kevon for a bunch of open looks. He knocked down 2 mid-range jumpers, which we're not used to seeing from Kevon. He also had several dunks. So I think offensively, that's exactly what the Warriors want to be doing. They have 35 assists. Anytime they're over 30, they're feeling good about themselves. They had a bunch of passes. The Clippers, who defensively had given the Warriors so much trouble in the second half of game 2 with that, what the Warriors call a gimmick defense, basically where they overguard the perimeter and try to prevent 3-pointers and threaten the double or triple team on Durant, that did not seem to be much of an issue last night.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole thing worked really well. And now we have to wait and see if that works against the Clippers for 2 more wins, and then how that carries over into the next series, assuming the Warriors get past this series.
Definitely. From your perspective, did game 2 kind of feel like a turning point, not just in this series, but potentially in this postseason for the Warriors?
Yeah, because, you know, everybody talks about wake-up calls and turning points and stuff like that. But to me, that was more than a loss. That was more than a loss to an opponent you should never lose to. That was like a disastrous meltdown. That was embarrassing. I think that was maybe the big takeaway for the Warriors. They were embarrassed by that game. They were humiliated. You can't blow a lead that big, you know. Everybody in the NBA, everybody blows leads. Every night you pick up the newspaper and you read that so-and-so won after coming back from 26 points behind. But a 31-point lead against a bad team in the playoffs, that doesn't happen. And I think as we get towards the end of the playoffs, and if they make the finals and then win the championship, that's going to be seen as a turning point, that game 2, where they just blew that game out their armpits.
Yeah, and I mean that was just one of the most stunning games I've ever covered. And I'm not looking for sympathy from the listener, but that was one of those nights where early in the game, I turned to Mark Medina from the Mercury News, who sits next to me, and I said, oh, tonight's going to be an easy night. You know, I'm going to write most of my story during the third quarter.
So you're the guy that jinxed it for us all.
Yeah, pretty much. I had this whole narrative ready to go. And then what happens, you know, the Clippers come back from down 31, ended up being one of the most stressful deadline situations of my life. Was able to file in time. We had the game ended at, I want to say, 10:28, and my deadline was 10:30. And so I had to somehow make sense out of that game within 2 minutes of the final buzzer. Hopefully I did that. The reader can be the judge of that. Anyone who picked up the print edition of the Chronicle the next day. But one of the other big takeaways from that game, and you know it's a crazy game when losing to Marcus Cousins for the rest of the postseason likely is not the biggest storyline. Obviously the historic nature of that collapse was, but what we saw last night was the first full game post DeMarcus Cousins. You saw the center rotation. You saw Andrew Bogut starting, Kevon Looney getting the lion's share of minutes off the bench in that spot. What were your thoughts on how that group was able to come together in the wake of a horrific injury to DeMarcus?
One thing, and I don't want to be insensitive or cruel to DeMarcus Cousins or anything like that, because it was a really gutty comeback from that Achilles injury, and he worked really hard. And he really wanted to fit in, and he was a good teammate by all accounts, and the guys enjoyed having him around. But my sense is that, well, he had some really good games, and he made some contributions, and he helped him in some ways, that it still wasn't a perfect fit. DeMarcus Cousins with the Warriors wasn't a perfect fit. They were working it out, and they would have kept working it out, and they would have kept working on it. But he may have been used less and less as the playoffs went on, and I guess this is a long way of saying that in some ways, I don't want to overstate it, but in some ways they might be better off with the group they have now, because Bogut certainly is fit and ready to play. And Kevon Looney looks great in backup role. So, you know, I don't want to say, oh, too bad. See you, DeMarcus. We didn't need you. But in some ways that, yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying, right?
I do think there's such a thing as having too many offensive options.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you saw at times with DeMarcus. When you have a scorer of that caliber in the low post, it's on you as Steve Kerr to find ways to get him involved, to find him in his spots, to draw plays for him. But in doing that, you're taking away some of what Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson and Steph Curry do. And I think what you saw last night was, I don't want to say a relief, but there was definitely some sort of satisfaction of getting back to what they're most comfortable with, you know, the blueprint that they leaned on to really to win their last two NBA titles, because they didn't have really this entire run. They haven't had a go-to big man. They haven't really had a go-to big man before Cousins since maybe what, Joe Barry Carroll?
Yeah.
Which is way before my time. And so I also think that this series was not a great matchup for DeMarcus. And it was almost a little awkward because it was his first ever postseason. There was obviously a lot of hype around that, a lot of excitement around that storyline. And he goes out in game one and really struggles because the Clippers don't really have a prototypical 7-foot center who plays big minutes. They start Ivaka Zubac, who is solid, but he's not near the player that Montrezl Harrell is. So, you know, what Doc Rivers has been doing, understandably, is starting Zubac, but bringing Harrell off the bench and playing him the lion's share of minutes at center. And Cousins is not a good matchup for Harrell. He's not quick enough. Defensively, he was getting exploited on pick and rolls. And you almost felt a little bad for him in game one. Obviously, you feel way worse for him in game two when he, 4 minutes into that game, goes down with that quad injury. But the reality is, this is a better matchup for Kevon Looney. And Kevon has been downright phenomenal.
To me, he looks really comfortable out there. You tell me what you think, but he looks like he feels right at home with these guys. He Yeah. Anytime a guy goes to the hoop, anytime a guy, staff or anybody else drives to the hoop, Kevon finds his little niche there. He finds a little area where they can dump off to him. He gets in the right position. He's got really good hands. You've seen guys in the past where, you know, they'll dump it off to him, a guy inside, and they'll fumble it. But he just seems very sure, and he seems almost calm out there. Like he's not panicked. He's not worried. And I think that's been impressive.
I think that if you didn't appreciate Kevon before this series, you're probably starting to appreciate him, because he's a guy who obviously is not going to wow you. Nothing he does is sensational. He's not going to have those highlight worthy plays, but what he does is his best basketball skills. He doesn't make mistakes. He is only 23, but he kind of has that old school savvy veteran type game. He understands angles. He knows how to switch off a ball screen and pick up a guard. He is really good at boxing out. He's really good at crashing the offensive glass. You know, he just does all the little things. He's good at setting screens. And I wrote about Kevon today, and some of these numbers are very impressive. Just looking at what he's done through three games in this series, he's totaled 35 points on 82.1% shooting, 11 rebounds, 2 blocks, 2 steals, and a plus 42 in 53 minutes, all while committing just one turnover. He's doing all that while being the best defensive option on Harrell and also repeatedly switching off ball screens to pick up Lou Williams. Yeah. So he's doing it all. And kind of going down the analytics rabbit hole a little bit today while working on this story, I stumbled upon a stat that really blew my mind. According to NBA.com, the Warriors outscored opponents by a team best 31.3 net rating with Looney on the floor during the regular season. That number plummeted to a minus 1.6 without him. A team best 31.3. Now, to put that in perspective, I believe they were like a plus 19.4 or something like that with Curry. Yeah. So now you don't want to read too much into that, because a lot of this stuff is dependent on who else is on the floor with them and that sort of thing. But regardless, I think it just kind of underscores his value to this team.
Plus, he's breaking out a little bit of a face up 17-foot jumper when they leave him wide open. And I know the mid-range jumper is now passe. It's nobody shoots it. But occasionally, when you get stuck and things bog down, and a guy like Looney gets the ball out near the free throw line and can turn around and just stick a little 15-foot jumper, that can come in handy. He had a couple of those last night.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is a nice little tool, because the reality of the situation is that when Kevon's out on the floor, the Clippers aren't really going to be paying attention to him. And they'll give him that mid-range jumper all day, every day. And if he can hit it, you know, that's free points for the Warriors. So that's a nice little wrinkle to what the Warriors do. You've seen Kevon hit that shot a couple times this season, but definitely not often. And for him to have the balls to bring out that jumper during a playoff game, I think says a lot about his confidence and where he feels, how he feels about himself. And, you know, we're talking a lot about Kevon, but Andrew Bogut, I think, has been great. Yeah. I did not cover this team the last time Andrew Bogut was on the Warriors. I started covering them right after he was traded, right after they signed Durant. So I followed the team a little bit from afar. I was familiar with how he did, where he was at physically, but is it fair to say that he's actually better right now than he was last time he was with the Warriors?
I think it is fair. For one thing, I think not that he was in bad shape then, because I remember at one point in his last season with the Lakers, with the Warriors, he went on a diet. He went on a no-sugar regimen, and he lost a bunch of weight, and he got gained energy and stuff like that. So he's never been a big slug or anything like that. But he went down to – when he played in Australia – I guess he kind of leaned out. He got leaner. He got a little quicker, I think. And I think, and also he plays with, I think, a higher appreciation of the game and a higher appreciation of the team he's playing with. And you know, it's weird, because where I usually sit at a game is like halfway up the arena. And so imagine the perspective from halfway up in an arena. Last night I was kind of low down, just off the floor. And what struck me is how springy Bogut was. It's kind of surprised me a little bit. Maybe he's always been like that and I never noticed because I was at a different angle. But seeing that close up, seeing, you know, he gets off the floor pretty well. He's not a gigantic leaper, but he got off the floor. He did a lot of tipping, a lot of rebounding. And also from that close up, you just see what amount of space he takes up. He's a big dude and he uses that size and he's a big presence in there.
I think this is one of those examples of the whole light years thing of the Warriors being five steps ahead. I mean, obviously they already had a relationship with Bogut, but a lot of people forgot that Bogut was even still playing basketball. A lot of people thought he completely retired from the game, and for them to have the insight and foresight to go out to send Larry Harris, assistant GM, the same guy who drafted Bogut number one overall with Milwaukee back in the day, to have him go out and scout him and talk to him about the possibility of coming back is really, really smart, because I think a lot of teams in that situation would have just gone with the best available guy in the league. You know, someone maybe who had just been bought out or waived. Obviously, there was talk about them wanting Robin Lopez. There wasn't really an obvious other option, but I'm sure they could have found someone. But I don't think anyone who could have transitioned to the Warriors as seamlessly as Bogut, because, I mean, the timing to me is just unbelievable how well it worked out. Life is all timing, right?
Right.
And this is the ultimate example of that, because he had just finished his season in Australia. He finished his season in Australia in late February, and that season was 30 games spread out over 5 months, which is perfect because it keeps him in shape, but it doesn't wear him out. So he's in game shape, but he doesn't feel the toll of an 82-game season. And in what you've seen from him since he's gotten to the Warriors is fresh legs, obviously, as you touched upon, enthusiasm. He said when he signed that he'd be totally fine just waving the towel on the sideline. And here he is starting playoff games, potentially will be starting in the NBA Finals. Like, how surreal of an experience does that have to be for him?
Yeah, you know, when they picked him up, I think I was like everybody else. I thought, oh, yeah, it's nice. It'll be interesting. It'd be fun to have Andrew Bogut back here. He's a good quote, and he's a charming guy to have around. But I don't think anybody thought he was going to come back and actually be this strong and this fit and fit back in as quickly. And Kerr talked about it yesterday, and we knew this, but it's not a secret, but Kerr elaborated on it, about this guy's IQ, his basketball IQ. And he came back, and it's basically the same system that they were running when he left, but there are some important wrinkles. One of them being Kevin Durant is now in the offense. And so there's a relearning process. And from what Kerr said, Bogut just picks things up instantly. You know, they tell him, okay, this is what we do with Kevin Durant. And, okay, I got it immediately. And it looks like he never left. It's just, it is, like you said, it's great timing. It was great thinking and planning to go down there and pick him up. And it's going to, if assuming it works out and continues, it's going to be a phenomenal story.
Yeah, not to get ahead of ourselves, but it kind of makes you wonder if he could come back next season. Because I know the talk had always been he's going to, you know, honor the second year of his contract in Australia. He's going to play with the Australian national team this summer after a potential finals run. He's going to go back to Australia, play another season with them, and call it a career. But if I'm the Warriors right now, I'm thinking you have another, probably at least another year or two left in you. I mean, you're extremely helpful right now. And given their center situation, their only center right now under contract for next season is Damian Jones, and they don't have any money. And so if you could just bring back Bogut on another minimum deal with zero expectation, that would be a smart move in a lot of ways. Even if he was really set on, you know, honoring his contract in Australia, you could work out a situation where, hey, let's just do the same thing. We'll leave that 15th spot open. You'll come back. You'll help us win in whatever capacity we need you for the playoffs and just do it one more year. I mean, I know they're not thinking about that right now, but seeing how spry he is and how helpful he is, you can't help but think about that as a possibility.
Not only that, but because the guy he is and because how smart he is, there's going to be a significant turnover with the Warriors next year. It won't be all this exact same roster. You have a lot of guys coming in, and they have a guy like him who knows the system so well and can work with other people. I think that would help the transition of new guys.
Yeah. I mean, I think he'd be a great coach. You know, he an assistant or something, maybe the next Jaren Collins, because he has such a good way about him. He's self-deprecating. He's easygoing. And I didn't know him, you know, obviously earlier in his career, but talking to him and talking to people around him, he's kind of changed his mindset in that I think earlier in his career, he let a lot of things get to him. He, I think, was really upset and jaded by the NBA and how fake a lot of people are and the broken promises. And, you know, I think he's felt kind of lied to at times in his career. And I think he got pretty cynical and negative toward the end of his time last time around with the Warriors. But since then, he's had two kids. He's been through some stuff personally. His grandfather, his uncle, who he was very close with, passed away. His wife had a high-risk pregnancy, and they thought she might not make it at one point. So he's been through some real stuff, and I think he has perspective on life. And he's come into this situation, and he hasn't been bothered by anything, you know, because from his perspective, this is all icing on the cake. And I think having that outlook has been a positive thing in a locker room that is trying to chase a three-peat.
Yeah. And plus, remember, he goes back to the Mark Jackson era, and he didn't really get along with Mark Jackson that well, I don't think.
That's an understatement. I think he hated Mark Jackson. I think he will tell you that he cannot stand Mark Jackson. I think he thought Mark Jackson was a fraud and fake and all the adjectives that go along with that.
Yeah, but not only on a personal level, but stylistically in basketball. You know, he traded in Mark Jackson, who he didn't get along with at all, and who ran a system that was kind of outmoded in a lot of ways, for Steve Kerr, who I think has a tendency to make a better connection with his players. And not only that, but brought in a great offense, which is Bogut-centric and is much better and is probably a lot more fun to play in.
One kind of interesting thing that happened today, the Warriors did not have practice today, but Steve did talk to media this morning at the team hotel. And anyone who knows Steve knows that he hates talking about free agency. He hates talking about personnel moves. That's not really his job. Whenever a reporter asks him about that, he always says, you should ask Bob Myers that, because that's Bob's job. But he went out of his way today to campaign or lobby for the team to sign Kevon Looney long term. He said, I'm really, really hoping that we can get him long term and we can give him the contract that he deserves so he can make some good money and we can enjoy having him on our team for many years. That's the plan. And here we are several months away from free agency, and he's already saying that. Now, the Warriors do have the bird rights for Kevon. And I apologize for my tweet yesterday. I tweeted something about how Kevon was potentially playing himself out of the Warriors price range. I had completely forgotten in that moment that the Warriors do have his bird rights. So that means that they can give him his market value, even though, you know, they don't, even though they're going to be capped out, they, if they're willing to go into the luxury, deeper into the luxury tax, they can give him whatever he is worth. And the way he's playing right now, if he can keep this up, I know he's a role guy, but you got to think he can command somewhere in the, what, $5 to $6 million range. He's making 1.6 right now. He's in line to probably quadruple his salary. And if I'm the Warriors, I'd love to have him for $5-6 million. This is a guy who's 23 years old, you know, knows the system. And I think he can be a real building block. I actually think that he's a guy, when there is that inevitable roster turnover, he can be a guy who is a top 6-7 guy on the roster.
Yeah. And that was a big deal that Kerr said that today, because some coaches would kind of do that routinely. Oh, we'd love to have this guy back, sign him up, you know. But Kerr doesn't do that. And the fact that he would do that, if you know, if Steve Kerr likes you enough to do that, man, sign the guy up.
Yeah. No, I mean, and if I'm the Warriors, and we've talked a lot about their center situation, they could do a lot worse than starting Kevon Looney at center. You could do a lot worse. Yeah. I think Kevon Looney is proven that he's a legitimate rotation guy on any team in this league, and you can play him starters minutes, whether or not he's coming off the bench or not, and feel confident about what you're going to get from him, because he does not make mistakes, and he does the little things. And as long as the Warriors have Steph and Klay, which I think they will for a long time, they don't need major offensive production out of that center position.
They just need to have him gain about 50 pounds so he can hold his own against the gigantic guys. But of course, that's not going to happen. But he fits in so well. And in that center right now, I don't know what it's going to be next year, but right now, center is obviously their weak position, and they're, and to have a guy like that come in and be extremely competent, man, that makes him really solid.
So one thing we haven't talked about, and you wrote about today, and I found it really interesting, is one, probably the most important aspect of this series, honestly, is that it is the Clippers' audition for free agents, namely a guy named Kevin Durant. This is the Clippers' chance to tell the Kawhi Leonards and Kevin Durants of the world, hey, we have something cool here, and you can come here and be the face of this franchise and understand that we have enough pieces here where if we just add one more superstar level guy, we can go from being a good team to a contending team. And especially given the fact that you have some pieces locked up long term, Harrell, I think, has proven that he is, you know, one of the better big men in the league. Lou Williams, I think you can make the case he's the best six man ever, which is saying a lot, but I think he's in that conversation. He's probably going to win his third career six man of the year award this year. And you have one of the best coaches in the league in Doc Rivers, and you play in LA, and we all know LA, we all know NBA players love LA. What do you think the chances are of Durant coming to the Clippers? Because I know they haven't really been talked about. It's been all about New York. But do you think he could surprise some people and come to the Clippers?
Yeah, I definitely think that. And we were talking earlier, but there's a lot of factors. One factor is Durant likes L.A. He trains here in the offseason. They have enough money to pay him. He just likes the place. And New York isn't the only place in the world. New York is very attractive, and a lot of players would love to play there. There's a glamour about it, but there's also a glamour about L.A., and usually that's been around the Lakers, but now the Clippers are kind of gaining some steam on that. And it seems to me like in the last few years, ever since they took Doc Rivers, they made him strictly a coach and not a general manager, and they kind of changed the front office around, and Jerry West has become more of an influence down there. They've made some really – I think they're seeing it as a team on the rise. They're making smart moves. They're making smart trades. They got rid of Blake Griffin. They got rid of Chris Paul. And those are great players and still somewhat almost borderline superstar players. But they got a lot of really good young stuff in return for them. And so I think they're seen as a team on the rise. And I think a guy like Durant would definitely look down here. You know, you have Doc Rivers as a coach. Everybody loves Doc. He would be a really good guy to play for, I would think, and players like him. That's another factor. And I just think that Durant, when it comes time to weigh all his options, he's not going to look at every team in the league. He's going to narrow it down. And I think the Clippers would be on a short list.
I also think that he would like the idea of playing on the other LA team, in that he would like sharing an arena with LeBron James, but not playing with LeBron James. Because we all know that there's definitely a dynamic there between LeBron and KD. And I think, in his heart of hearts, KD believes that he's the greatest player in the world. And I think he would love the opportunity to come to LA and say, hey, LeBron, you can't even make the playoffs. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to take this Clippers team and I'm going to make the finals. I'm going to win a title. So it would kind of be an opportunity for him to elevate his status in the public's eyes ahead of LeBron, which I think is something that he would think about if he's seriously considering the Clippers. I'm honestly surprised that there hasn't been more talk about LeBron coming to the Clippers, because I think in a lot of ways they make even more sense than the Knicks. I understand why people are saying the Knicks, but I think that he could come here next year and take them to the finals, which I'm not sure he could do in New York, yeah, even with Kyrie.
And it just, yeah, it makes sense in so many ways. Kevin Durant is such a confident guy, and I believe he thinks he could walk into this town. He can make a difference. He could take over. I think there's still the feeling that in Golden State that he's still second fiddle to Steph, and he always will be. And he's a sensitive guy, and there are a lot of people who think that he feels that way. Not that Steph is a jerk or trying to overshadow him or anything, but Steph, by just being Steph and his wonderfulness, kind of will always be the big story and be the big hero in town. And Kevin would like to go to a place where he would be the hero, not because he's a glory guy, but just because he wants to be recognized, I guess, wants to be recognized for what he truly is. What he said to us in the last few days, he knows who he is. I'm Kevin Durant. And that's a guy who doesn't want to be just another player on a team. And down here with the Clippers, that's what he would be. He would be a big guy, huge guy.
That's kind of the unique thing about this situation is they're, you know, a playoff level team that has zero superstars. I mean, there would be zero question he would come and it would be Kevin Durant's team. I mean, I don't think he has to worry too much about Lou Williams still in the spotlight. Lou Williams is very good, but he is not in the same stratosphere as Kevin Durant. I don't know. It's interesting. It's worth looking at. And honestly, there's part of me that feels that because there's so much talk and discussion and written about him going to New York, knowing Kevin a little bit, I feel like he would love the opportunity to say, you guys all thought I was going to New York? Yeah, it's just what you guys know. I'm going to the Clippers. You know, I could totally see him doing that.
Yeah. Not only that, but, you know, since he talked a couple years ago, I did an interview with him, and he talked about how much he's gone to school with the Warriors in terms of wanting to eventually become an NBA team owner. He studied Joe Lacob, he studied Bob Myers, studied Rick Wells. He studies the way the team is run. And so I think he's gained an appreciation for the importance of how well an NBA team is run. And when he starts shopping around, if he's objective, he's going to look at New York and he's going to see that that is not the role model for the way an organization should be run in the NBA. Whereas the Clippers, maybe not number one on the list of the greatest organizations, maybe the Warriors are still number one on that, but the Clippers aren't far behind. They're very progressive. They're very smart, intelligent. They don't do a lot of stupid things. And I think that would really be high on his list.
Yeah, no. And like I said, I think that storyline honestly could end up being the most important storyline to come out of this series. If he does end up signing with the Clippers this summer, everyone's going to look at this series and everyone's going to be analyzing, oh, he's just so impressed by what he saw in that series. And was that the moment that he said, you know what, I should be a Clipper? There would be so much speculation around that. Is that going to happen? Who knows? But I think that it makes a lot more sense. And I'm honestly wondering why there hasn't been more talk about it. Anyway, going into game four on Sunday, do you feel like the Clippers have another punch in them, or do you feel like this is pretty much done? You know, they had their awesome moment in game two, and now the Warriors are ready to get going and face probably Houston in the next round, which is going to be probably a much tougher test.
I don't think the Clippers are a typical first round eighth seed, you know, punching bag, just, okay, give a nice fight and then lay down. I think from what we've seen so far and what Doc Rivers has said talking about his team, this is a kind of an unusual team. They're unusually scrappy and they have a lot of confidence in themselves. So I don't think they're going to go down easy. But the fact is the Warriors have found themselves and they are really determined. And one thing they don't want to do, they really don't want to stretch this out into like a 6 or 7 game series. That would just, it would be stupid on a lot of levels for them. It would be really destructive. Physically, if nothing else, they just don't want to have to play another game against these guys. They got to save everything they can in the tank for the next round. So they're going to be determined. I don't think we're going to see any more blown 31-point leads. Let's put it that way.
Well, thanks, Scott, for joining me. It's been fun having you in LA. Always good to have you on the road with me. And we'll definitely do this after game four.
Thanks, Connor, and let's go out again and bring LA to its knees.
I want to thank Scott Oster for joining me on this week's podcast. It's always good chatting Warriors with someone who has followed the team as long as he has.
Warriors Off Court is part of the San Francisco Chronicle podcast network. Audrey Cooper is the editor-in-chief. If you like this show, we'd love it if you subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've got a minute to give us a quick review, that helps us build our audience so we can keep growing. Follow me on Twitter at @con_cron and email me at cleturno@sfchronicle.com. Support Warriors Off Court and a lot of great journalism with a subscription to the San Francisco Chronicle. There are print and digital editions. Find out more at sfchronicle.com/subscribe.